Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Christy Jordan, a member of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ralph Torres. Was trained as an engineer and a geotechnical engineer. He has had a long and illustrious career with the California Department of Water Resources and has managed hundreds of design, construction, and investigation projects for our levees, our dams, as chief of the civil engineering branch. In 2006, Mr. Torres was appointed by the governor to be Deputy Director of the State Water Project. This is the nation's largest water and power development and conveyance system. The State Water Project provides drinking water for over 23 million people, the irrigation for 750,000 acres of farmland, and directly sustains over $400 billion of California's economy. In addition, the State Water Project is the single largest consumer of electrical power in California. Today, Mr. Torres will speak to us about California's interconnected water and energy systems and the unique aspects of the State Water Project's response to statewide initiatives, including renewable energy and the reduction of greenhouse gases. Please join me in welcoming Ralph Torres.
Thank you, Christy, and thank you all for the opportunity to address you tonight, and I thank the Commonwealth Club for sponsoring this and to provide me with the opportunity to perhaps provide you information that you didn't have before about the State Water Project. I have one little correction to make, and that is that as of September, I decided to change career paths, and so my appointment by the governor ended around September 1st. But I'm still with the Department of Water Resources working on some very interesting projects that involve the State Water Project. And so so I've moved on, you might say, a bit, and looking forward to the next stages of my career as well. What I'm going to talk about tonight is, of course, the State Water Project, but in particular, its relationship with the electrical system, electrical grid, and its own power needs in the state of California, and what we're doing with respect to trying to make the State Water Project greener and bringing on renewables as part of our power portfolio. Most folks think of the State Water Project as primarily a water delivery system, which it is, but we have a very large component of electrical component because of all the electricity that's required to move water in the state. That's where you hear that we're the single largest consumer, and that's a single entity. But, you know, compared to others, and I'll get into this, compared to others like Pacific Gas and Electric, we have, you know, that type of consumption, that's different. But we're the single largest entity consumer. I just want to describe what you're seeing here today. And on the left is a photograph of Oroville Dam, part of the State Water Project. A lot of folks don't know that it's the tallest dam in the United States. A lot of folks think it's Hoover or one of those, but it's actually Oroville Dam at 770 feet high. The photograph in the middle is also somewhat popular in that a lot of folks who are driving on I-5 down towards Southern California see those big pipes that go up the hill down near Bakersfield. That's our Chrisman pumping plant, one of many pumping plants that we have on the system. And, of course, many of you drive along the freeways and see a large aqueduct, especially in the Central Valley, and that's the California Aqueduct. And so these are some of the topics I'm going to cover here tonight. Let me start with our mission. And, you know, several years ago, that went through the era of writing mission statements and vision statements, and, of course, DWR is no different. This particular one we struggled with for several months, and Director David Kennedy at the time really came in and helped us solidify the mission, which is to manage the water resources of California in cooperation with other agencies to benefit the state's people and to protect, restore, and enhance the natural and human environments. In recent years, that balance of beneficial uses between the needs of the natural and human environments has really been at the forefront. You often may read about court decisions and other tensions that are occurring primarily in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. And it's funny how you write one of these mission statements and it actually becomes very true. The State Water Project is actually a multi-purpose project. It also provides flood control at our reservoirs and dam facilities. Its main feature is a water supply facility, but it also provides lots of recreation at our lakes, fishing along the aqueduct. And of course, it also helps by our hydro generation plants. It helps California's energy situation and helps the grid tremendously. The water deliveries of the Water Project, we serve about 25 million people, primarily in Southern California and the coastal areas. And we help irrigate or provide water for irrigation in the Central Valley primarily for about 750,000 acres of farmland. The total water supply contracts with our 29 water supply contractors is about 4.2 million acre feet. Now, this doesn't always happen. It's very highly dependent on precipitation, water supply, snowpack, and demand. Yes. Well, let me qualify that. We have had 4.2 million acre feet available, but the demand didn't request that amount. Delivery averages is approximately, the average deliveries have been about 3.3 million acre feet. Water use distribution is about 30% ag and about 70% urban. And that has been changing over the years. It used to be probably closer to 50-50 when the project first started, and it's been slowly migrating towards more urban and industrial and less agricultural. 95% of all the costs are paid for by the 29 contractors who are local public agencies. That other 5% you might be wondering about is a recreation component. And there is a law called the Davis-Dolwig Act, which states that if in recreation is a benefit to all of the people of the state of California, and so it should be covered by the general fund instead of a specific the water contractors. And so that 5% probably takes up about 75% of my time, though. Just briefly, you know, there are many water projects in the state of California. You may have heard about the Central Valley Project with Shasta Dam, but let me describe to you the main elements here of the State Water Project. We have lots of storage facilities from Oroville Dam, actually starting up in the Upper Feather River with three dams up there that create reservoirs that are primarily recreation use. Then we come down to our main storage facility at Oroville. And then the water travels down the Feather River and the Sacramento Rivers into the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, and we have the North Bay Aqueduct delivering water to Napa and Solano counties. We have our South Bay Aqueduct delivering to Santa Clara counties. We go on down to San Luis Reservoir near Los Banos, and it continues down to the Coastal Aqueduct into San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, and then down into the West Branch near Los Angeles. Oops, let me go back. And then on the East Branch into San Bernardino, into the San Bernardino area. The total, it's about 700 miles of canals and pipelines. We have some pump generating plants that allow for pump back, 5 hydroelectric power plants, and we actually have a coal-fired power plant that I'll talk in more detail, which is in Las Vegas. Now, you can see from that we have large elevation changes in the project, and this provides us with both an issue of having to use a lot of electricity to pump water to those elevations, but at the same time, it also helps us, it provides the opportunity for hydropower. Where the where elevations are dropping, we're able to pick up that energy and actually generate electricity. And so over the 700 miles from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, We have, in some cases, elevation changes in the Central Valley over the Tehachapi Mountains of up to about almost 3,000 feet. We have one pumping plant at Edmondson Pumping Plant near Bakersfield that has a single lift of over 1,900 feet. So a little bit more detail about pumping and generating. Now, again, the water project is the single largest power consumer in California. We have a pumping capacity, in other words, the energy that's needed to pump, of about 2,600 megawatts. We consume a large amount of electricity, 6,000 to 9,600 gigawatt hours, just to move the water. Now, 40 to 60% of that comes from our own resources in our hydro generation, which means that we have to purchase the rest. Now, we are also the third largest generator of clean hydropower, and our generation capacity is about 1,700 megawatts. And on average, we generate about 4 to 7,000 gigawatt hours. This produces about 14% of California's hydropower. So we are a net consumer of electricity, even though we generate quite a bit of electricity on our own. However, if you compare us to other utilities, it kind of gives you the magnitude of scale of where we rest with the rest of the state. We use about 3% of all the electricity in California. So compared to other public utilities like Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern Cal Edison, SMUD, you know, they might have a much larger use because of their customer base. Although if you look at us as a utility, we're the sixth largest electrical consumption by utility, but we're only about 9% of the size of Pacific Gas and Electric. A little bit more about our pump load and where that electricity comes from. Again, we have large hydro, which is our generators at Oroville and in Southern California, provides about 53% of the power that we use. We have some small, what's considered small hydro, which is less than a plant with less than 30 megawatts, contributes about 4%. Now, we have a coal resource in Las Vegas, the Reed Gardner plant. That provides about 13% of our energy. And then the rest we have to purchase, make market purchases on the market to provide the rest of the electricity that we need to move water. Here's an example of one of our largest users of electricity. This is the Edmondson Pumping Plant. Again, it lifts water 1,926 feet over the Tehachapi Mountains. It has a plant capacity of 4,480 CFS. That's cubic feet per second. A cubic foot is about the size of a basketball, and so imagine 4,480 of those moving by you each second. There are 14 pumps, and so think about the horsepower that your automobile might have. These pumps are 80,000 horsepower each, and there's 14 of them, so which is a large demand on the electrical grid when this plant is running. Now, some of the benefits that we have on the grid, because we are hydroelectric, we have what are called load dropping agreements, which means that on a particularly hot day in California in the middle of the summer where there's a peak demand and the resources, electrical resources, are nearing their safe limit, we can actually turn pumps off and reduce that stress on the grid. And we have agreements with the California Independent System Operator. We used to have agreements with Pacific Gas and Electric, but now they're with others, to be able to do that during that period of time. Now, the other thing that we do is State Water Project's off-peak power use means we are cycling up and down. The entire project, the entire system, was actually designed to pump water at what's called off-peak, or at night when the demand is lower, and to generate the electricity during the peak hours when there's a greater demand for electricity. So you'll see our plants, like at Oroville, generating at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when the peak demand is. Then we have what are called after bays, which are reservoirs that hold that water, and then we release it to the Feather River on a very controlled basis. And so that's a benefit to the state, in that we're not using electricity or much electricity, or try not to use much electricity during the peak hours. Now, the state's water reduction of on-peak pumping, that does reduce the stress on the grid. Other benefits that we have, operational issues that also prevent us from operating in a particular manner. There's a lot of environmental issues, as you no doubt have heard, in the Delta. And so sometimes we have a restricted window of when we can move water due to those environmental impacts. And so that causes us to have to move more water during a particular period of time. And so that might mean that we are pumping more on peak. And so that's certainly increases the cost and creates greater stress on the grid. But because of our restricted amount of time, that's how we have to move water during that that period of time. Now, greenhouse gas emissions, of course, we are in a program now where we're trying to reduce the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we produce from our project. But to give you, again, the magnitude of scale of how much greenhouse gas is produced by the water project, of course, the greater production is in the transportation area, in the industrial areas, and the electrical power areas that are using natural gas or coal. And you can see the State Water Project is about 0.6 or a little over one-half of 1% of the greenhouse gas emissions in California. We have a program going on right now to try to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. There's Assembly Bill 32 that was passed several years ago to try to reduce gas or mandates that for utilities to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Our plan is to reduce by 50% below the 1990 levels by 2020, which exceeds the Assembly Bill 32 goals. And primarily we're going to be doing that in several ways that I'll get into, but primarily it's by the elimination of our coal-fired power plant in Las Vegas. The state, under Governor Schwarzenegger, mandated that we not own coal-fired plant. And so our contract with Nevada Power ends in 2013, so we will be divesting ourselves of that plant in 2013. And then our plan is to reduce our greenhouse gases by 80% by 2050. Again, the main way that we're doing that is by the termination of the coal-fired resource. There are four units at this particular coal-fired plant near Las Vegas, and we own a quarter or one of those four units. And actually, we own only 67.8% of that unit, which is about 270 megawatts. So, again, we will not be renewing that contract. And we're going through some very complex negotiations with Nevada Power right now in that through that divesting of that power plant. We are also looking at a more solar generation on the aqueduct. Now, as we talked about earlier, we have large-scale uses and generation of power on the State Water Project. And so when we look at some of the solar fields that we're able to produce, they're going to certainly help contribute, but it's not likely that we'll be able to, you know, convert entirely to solar with the amount of electricity that we're using. But we get a lot of calls on whether we can put solar panels within our right-of-way, you know, adjacent to the canal or over the canal. I've probably talked to at least a dozen entities, solar manufacturers and companies that have asked about that opportunity. One of the problems with putting panels over the aqueduct is that we have an aging infrastructure that requires a lot of maintenance, and there's a lot of encroachment now of urban areas that are along the canal. So, you know, it's a public safety issue. And so by having panels that are on the canal or over the canal really kind of inhibits our ability to safely operate the canal. But we do have property that is adjacent to the canal, and solar works better in large rectangular areas. And so one of the areas where we're actually teaming with the University of California to build a large solar field is at our Pear Blossom pumping plant. This plant is near Palmdale. It's just east of Palmdale, about 20 miles, and it's in one of the what they call the sweet spots in terms of being able to produce solar energy. And so we have presently about 68 acres that we can use to create about 13 megawatts of solar. University of California, in particular, here in Oakland with the Regents, and in particular with UC Irvine, are proposing to team with us and buy adjacent properties around our property and try to increase the amount of solar power that we can generate at this site. and then we'll divide the power up between our use and their use on about a 50-50 basis. What makes this site attractive for us at this point in time is, one, we already own it, and then there aren't very many environmental issues. I mean, it's really a desert region. This March, we're going to be doing the actual environmental surveys to see what type of impacts we might have at this site. Actually, the site that the Department of Water Resources owns is an old spoil site that was created by the excavation for the power plant. So it's even has less environmental impacts than some of the adjacent land. So we're hoping to expand this up to 20 megawatts. And the way we think we're going to do it is by just, putting out a request for proposals and having a solar company come in and build it and operate it for us. And we'll just, take the benefits of the plant and we'll pay them whatever they're going to charge for that particular electricity through a power purchase agreement. And we're in the preliminary stages of that process right now. This very complex process is we have to file applications, of course, with Southern Cal Edison for the use of their transmission facilities. And we think that we're going to be able to get this online in about 2 years. So, we come up and we're excited with these projects, and then sometimes they take so long that you just kind of takes the gas out of you a little bit. But that's the way these all are. We've also invested in the Lodi Energy Center near Sacramento. This is a new type of combined cycle natural gas plant that burns much cleaner, and it is able to turn on and turn off faster, so it also can help the grid. We are one of many partners on this project. Our share is 90 megawatts, or about 33% of the facility, and we're investing about $140 million for this. And this is supposed to be operational, and they're on schedule, but it'll be operational this coming summer. And again, more about the Lodi Energy Center. Now, it's fast start technology, which again, it able to respond to emergencies on the grid very easily. It helps provide firm power for renewable energy like solar power, which is intermittent or means that, it doesn't produce electricity all day long. The same with wind energy. So these type of plants help balance that difference between other renewables. We are in the process of completing our first phase of replacing four of our pumps at Edmondson Pumping Plant. You can get an idea of the size of these pumps with the folks standing there at the base. And they're in a building that is about five stories tall. What you don't see here in this photograph is actually the motor, 80,000 horsepower motor that goes on top of the pump that actually turns the pump. And so there's a big piece of it that you don't see in this photograph. But we advertised, put out a contract, and Hitachi Corporation designed and built four new pumps for us that are much more efficient than the older pumps. And so these new pumps are actually using less energy to move the same amount of water. If you were to, the equivalent amount of energy that saved is kind of equivalent to about 12 acres of solar panels per pump. And we're investigating right now and looking at the feasibility of replacing 11 more pumps at or 7 more pumps at Edmondson. Some of the other green activities, we are in the process of going into requests for proposals for more wind and solar energy. Just yesterday we met with Calpine Corporation to look at their facilities in the geysers and look at geothermal energy. We also are looking at developing small hydro on our own. We have some facilities where we have, a difference in water surface elevations that we might take advantage of and be able to generate some clean electricity that way. We are involved with the Climate Action Registry, where we report and verify emissions for the State Water Project. We're reporting again this year for the Climate Registry, and we're reporting annually to the Air Resources Board, and we're participating in the Governor's Climate Action Team. I may have. So in summary, you see that we're primarily a water conveyance facility, but we have a big role in California's energy production, primarily hydroelectric power, and we do provide some benefits with that. We have a greenhouse gas policy that will meet or exceed Assembly Bill 32. Again, we have benefits to the electrical grid, and we're, you know, pursuing a renewable portfolio. And so we're switching from coal to cleaner natural gas, and we're trying to develop small hydro. So all of these things, we're hoping that we have a more efficient and cleaner state water project in the future. And thank you. I'll be entertaining any questions you might have this time.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Water and Energy, the California State Water Project with Ralph Torres. Okay.
Many of your problems may be justified in some cases and others not. What worried me many years ago, you were considering increasing the height of the Oroville Dam, which you just talked about. And I think the people who were interested in wild river rafting stopped all that. Whatever happened to that particular concern? Were you able to increase the height of the Oroville Dam, or did they prevent you from doing that?
No, actually, the raising of Oroville Dam is not being considered any longer, and I doubt that it ever will be again. That's part of the reason for it, but the other part for it is that raising the dam will actually change a lot of the operational requirements and schedules for the dam. It'll decrease our ability to react as quickly to flood control, for example, by having more water behind the dam. And that's probably the primary concern, at least for the department, is being able to operate in a safe manner with a greater height, with a higher dam.
So and you're saying it wasn't the Wild River rafters who stopped the project?
No, it wasn't.
Okay, another question?
Well, thank you very much. The interface of water resources with renewable energy resources is just fantastic. You spoke about the smaller hydroelectric. Are there going to be a river run?
No. Our river run opportunities on the State Water Project are all gone. And so what we are looking at is you might consider they're called in-pipe hydro. In other words, they're on conveyance facilities that we already have. Let me give you an example. At our Oroville facilities, we have Thermalito Afterbay, and that's where the water comes out and where it's stored so that we can have a regulated flow to the river. We also, out of that same reservoir, deliver water to local contractors, primarily rice irrigation farmers. And so in that outlet, there's a considerable head difference of over 27 feet. And so they have a fairly constant flow going through there. So it appears that it provides the opportunity to build a small hydro plant there on the order of maybe between 1 and 2 megawatts. So we're also looking at, again, in Southern California, we have some plants that aren't expanded, that aren't built out to their full capacity. One example is our Alamo power plant. It presently has 1 18-megawatt unit, but it has already built into the plant room to place another one. And so we're looking at those kind of opportunities.
I have more questions.
With the difference between the consumption and what you require and what you produce, how much of that is required to be met by renewable sources?
How much of the difference is required to be renewable? It's really not measured that way. The way they measure the load that we have is primarily what we require to become renewable. And so we're looking at probably somewhere on the order of, I believe, 20% or so of that will become renewable.
I have a question. We hear so much about America's failing infrastructure and severe budgetary restrictions. Can you make a comment about the long-term future of California's dams, levees, and aqueducts, please?
Well, in general, not only in California but across the nation, you'll see such or hear about such things as the American Society of Civil Engineers report card, for example, that rates different pieces of infrastructure. The State Water Project that I'm very familiar with has been able to keep up with maintaining its infrastructure. And perhaps primarily one of the big differences between in the way it's budgeted is that all of the costs are paid for by the water users, the 29 water contractors. So it's not dependent upon a general fund source of funding. Now, that's not to say that those water users don't also have economic hardships, especially in these times. And so we have to be cognizant and be able to schedule our projects to try to have the least impact on their cash flow as well. Now, our state water contractors and the department work very closely in being able to ensure that we don't have our schedule some very large expenditure, for example, that they may have great effects on their cash flow. And so, but we have been able to maintain our aqueduct to a certain degree to operate safely. We do have some areas there where they're 50 years old. Our Gianelli pumping plant, for example, is a dual facility where that, what I mean by that is it's owned by the federal government and operated by the state. We have valves, large valves, half the size of this room type of valves, that are over 40 years old, and they need to be, replaced or repaired in a major repair. And so we have a lot of those kind of projects down the line because we do have a 50-year-old project.
You mentioned creating power and moving the power. Do you see or are you going to be creating opportunities to take a look at the inefficiencies of transmission to help make that power go a little farther?
I know that's an important part of it, but the department does not own any transmission. The transmission that we use is primarily operated by the California Independent System Operator, but owned by either Southern California Edison or Pacific Gas and Electric. So we don't have much to do with transmission.
Except using it. And correct. Some moral suasion with how you'd like to use it a little more efficiently.
We certainly would. I mean, it would be certainly to our benefit.
It seems like given that there's some level of embedded energy in the water that you're using, you could actually save energy by reducing the amount of water that you're pumping through your system. So given that it's a two-part question. First, do you have a sense of what that energy to water conversion is, how many, million acre feet there are per megawatt hour, or rather the other way around, how many megawatt hours there are per million acre feet? And then second, has the Department of Water Resources looked at programs like leak detection or seasonal pricing as a way to actually save energy as well as saving water?
Yeah, I don't have those numbers off the top of my head. I could probably get a hold of them and get back to you, though. The whole issue of reducing consumption or reducing demand is certainly an important one, and we have an Office of Water Conservation that helps local agencies with that. And as, as a state government, we have a public trust responsibility also to make sure that folks are using water efficiently. The state water project part that I'm responsible for is primarily the utility and responsible for making deliveries to those other entities. But a lot of that work, I think, is more likely to happen from our customers' point of view, those folks who actually receive the water and who probably have greater opportunities for finding more efficient uses and leak detections in their system. We do have concerns about, leak detection on the California aqueduct, and we have areas that are monitored daily. In fact, the entire aqueduct is monitored daily, both by vehicle and by flyover. And so whenever we do spring leaks, and believe me, with a 50-year-old, 700-mile-long canal, we do have leaks. But we are able to react to them quickly and hopefully protect them. The design of the aqueduct using clay liners and concrete liners has helped reduce seepage. But again, over time, those systems don't work as effectively as they once did. So we do have that issue going on.
Yeah, I was just wondering how water is delivered contractually to the end users. And, I assume that you guys deliver water to agencies and co-ops and whatnot. But I was just wondering if they have an annual allotment that was established a long time ago and how that works and whether it changes frequently.
Yes, we do. And I'm glad you asked because that's what my new assignment is. We have long-term, what are called long-term water supply contracts. The piece of legislation called the Burns-Porter Act that established the State Water Project provided the Department of Water Resources the authority to enter into long-term contracts with the folks who would be ultimately receiving the water. So the way that was apportioned was, it was calculated or estimated a long time ago, during the 1950s, what the potential yield of that project would be. And then as contractors signed on and signed a contract with the department, they signed on for a particular piece of that total allotment. For example, Metropolitan Water District of Southern California is around 2 million acre feet. And that's not a very accurate number. I'm just talking off the top of my head. But they're the biggest customer. The next largest customer is Kern County Water Agency with about 25% of the total. And then it goes down to very small amounts. And so the way they pay for the project is very complex and interesting. They actually pay depending on the cost of delivering water to that point. So the further you are away from, say, the delta from where it's, the transportation begins, the more you pay for the water. And so then the amount of water they receive every year is dependent on how much rainfall we receive and what the condition of the reservoirs are and what the water quality is and what the other environmental issues are in the export of water. So then we go through those calculations on a yearly basis, and starting in November, we'll provide an estimate of how much water we think we're going to deliver during that year. And so, of course, the November estimates are very rough and very conservative. So some years we start off, a couple years ago, we started off with an estimate of like 5 or 10% of what their total allocation would be. In one particular year, we were able to predict that we were going to allocate up to 100%. And so it varies greatly. They also have what are called fixed costs and variable costs. For example, the capitalized cost of the project, they have to pay independent of how much water they receive. The other variable cost, which depends on energy and other operations cost, vary from year to year. Hence, they're called variable. Is that?
Okay. Thank you.
Hi. I'm really happy to hear that you're investing in renewable energy, such as solar and wind. I was just more curious about our older infrastructures have inabilities to store these renewable energies for long points of time. I was wondering if your company is remedying these storage issues, or if this isn't a concern of yours, if this is somebody else's.
Well, that's an excellent point. And what some folks are looking at very closely, and something that was actually designed into our project from the initial design, was what are called pump storage facilities. And these are facilities where you can generate during the peak hours and then pump back into the upper reservoir during the off-peak hours and take advantage of that system. Some folks consider this to be the battery, if you will, to use in combination with solar and wind generation. There is a big project being designed right now in Southern California by the Eagle Crest Company, I believe they are, and they have a website. It's down near Joshua Tree National Forest. And it's a large pump-back facility that they are designing and thinking that it would work very well in combination with a large solar plant that is being planned somewhere out there in the desert. And so that kind of, water storage is considered like a battery that you can store. Otherwise, it's very difficult to store electricity. I mean, you have to use whatever you're generating. And that's where hydro again comes in, because it provides that flexibility to ramp up or ramp down as needed.
On the topic of water storage, I was wondering if you could explain to us how groundwater recharge works and how you can use groundwater as an underground reservoir.
That's a good question. You know, California has some very large aquifers that some have gone, haven't been tapped very much. The Tuscan Aquifer, I believe it's called in Northern California, is fairly substantial. In the Kern County area, there's the Kern Water Bank, which is a water banking system originally designed by the Department of Water Resources. And you create storage ponds by building small dikes in large areas. You fill those, and the water transmits down through the soil to the groundwater table, and it helps supply or add to the groundwater table. That's measured. And then when needed, they pump that water back out for beneficial use. And that's the basics of a groundwater bank. And those are being used more and more in California.
Thank you.
Yeah, in talking about both water banking and the mission of DWR, I saw that the trustee responsibility was not mentioned in the original mission statement. But isn't there, to answer the question about contracts without any mention of what's called paper water, I mean, is a concern of the California public, and some of these transactions are happening without any public knowledge of them. Are you concerned about that as a public trustee for the California public?
Yeah, but personally, I am. I don't think that there's any reason to conduct any of these negotiations in secret. There's an agreement that was reached a few years ago called the Monterey Agreement. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's exactly it. And the part of that requires that all water transfers now that require an EIR in the State Water Project be held in a public forum. The renegotiation of the state water contracts, of the long-term water supply contracts, that negotiation between the water contractors and DWR under the Monterey Agreement requires that it occur in public. And so I'm a firm supporter of that. I was the executive manager for the relicensing of Oroville facilities. That was probably one of the largest collaborative processes of any relicensing in the nation. Everyone was invited, and some days it seemed like everyone attended. And after 2 years of negotiation, we were able to reach a settlement agreement with 52 entities and, in essence, all of the environmental agencies. And there were very few folks who did not sign our settlement agreement. So I think public processes work, and I think as government, I think that we are required to do public processes. I know that always hasn't been the case, especially in water, but I think it should be.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you were listening to Water and Energy, the California State Water Project, with Ralph Torres.
As water flows through the aqueduct from the Delta all the way down to Los Angeles, through the hot Central Valley in generally open, uncovered aqueduct, what percent of the water originating in the Delta evaporates along the way, and what steps are you taking to reduce that?
I don't have the number for you exactly. I can get it for you. We do monitor evaporation not only in the canal but in our reservoirs, and it's included in the formulas that we use for delivery. To this point in time, I have not heard that it is, you know, so large an amount that it is a concern for water deliveries. Now, to be able to prevent evaporation either in a large reservoir or in a large open channel is very difficult to do. I've heard that, you know, some of the solar purveyors have discussed putting, you know, some of the solar panels over the aqueduct as a way of reducing evaporation. And you may be able to reduce temperature by a small amount, but the other factors that affect evaporation out of water, you won't be able to change. And plus, we're looking at essentially 400 miles of open channel. So I'm not really sure in reality how much of an impact that would have.
Thank you. Another question?
I wanted to ask you about frack water. And, you know, we hear about fracking and the fracking industry and the impact it's having. We hear a lot about it in mostly other parts of the country, but I've heard that it's...
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing you, or I don't understand.
I'm sorry, fracking. It's the practice that's being commonly done in a lot of places in the U.S. where they basically go underground to extract gas, and it's called fracking, and it's also having an effect on aquifers and natural water sources. And so far, a lot of the attention has gone to some major aquifers and projects in New York State, Pennsylvania, but there's talk of that also being a threat to California. I just wanted to know, in your experience and in your work, have you had to deal with any of that? Have they entered California? Has that been an issue at all, frack water and frack water contamination?
Yeah, I have no experience personally in that.
All right.
Thank you. Another question?
Yeah, I've heard that the largest electricity usage in the Bay Area is for pumping water. But after hearing you today, I'm thinking, is that not true? When we give climate change presentations at one of the local nonprofits, they say, oh, I've heard several times, one of the very largest electricity usage is pumping water. And so we should save water because we're helping climate change. So... is that just wrong, or what's your opinion about that?
No, I think what you may be hearing, that what I've heard, is that it's not only the conveyance of water, but it's also water treatment. The cleaning, you know, water treatment is a large user of electricity in California. And so I think it's the whole combined conveyance, treatment, delivery to the tap that consumes large amounts of electricity. So conservation is always a good idea.
On the topic of water treatment, reclaim, recycling municipal water and municipal sewage is on a very fast growth track. And do you have a comment about whether the state has responsibility about this or whether it's a municipal water district responsibility? And what could the state do to try to overcome public resistance to reclaim?
Sure. The State Water Project in itself does not deliver treated water and does not deal with reclaimed water. It is a raw water delivery system similar to the Central Valley Project. Now, there are some large reclaimed water programs going on right now that I'm aware of in Southern California. And we do have a program that provides local assistance to those areas that are involved in projects such as reclaimed water through our Office of Water Conservation. And we do have some grant funding available, so that we are able to support some of that.
Another question?
Two short questions. One, is your department involved in the renovation of the water delivery system from Shasta into San Francisco?
No.
Who's in?
That's the Central Valley Project. That's the Bureau of Reclamation.
Bureau of Reclamation. And the second one, is there concerning your department, kind of what happened with PG&E is when people actually conserved on energy, that they were claiming they weren't getting enough revenue, so they need to increase their rates?
That's a very good question. And, in fact, in part of the renewal of the long-term water supply contracts, we have to be able to look at affordability. And it's, again, a complex question. We have, you know, what are capitalized costs that will come in when you start doing major renovations to projects. And you also have the variable costs related to energy use and operations. The part that's most likely to affect the bills of the end consumer would be those large capitalized costs that are needed just to, you know, to be able to maintain a reliable system. As you conserve water, it depends a lot on how that local agency is collecting its revenue. And that's something that we don't get involved with. I mean, they collect their revenue to pay the bills that we send them. Some agencies rely entirely on user fees in order you pay for what you use, or you pay a fixed amount per month for water. Others are able to include it in their county tax bills, as well as being able to have a charge for water. And so it is a concern, and it is one of the axioms that we have in our negotiations, or will have in our negotiations with the water contractors, is to be able to maintain a reliable system that is still affordable. You know, what our likelihood of achieving that is, I hope it's good, but as time goes on, these systems do get expensive.
Okay, thank you. Another question?
We have a number of different water users in the state by constituencies such as industrial, agricultural, and residential. Of those different constituencies, which ones do you see have most opportunity to innovate in terms of their use and reuse of water?
Well, I think the opportunities lie probably with the largest customers, and that would be, you know, municipal water districts, municipal and industrial water districts, particularly in Southern California and some of the Bay regions. It's not to say that they haven't already been doing a lot of that. You know, it started years ago with, you've heard the term xeriscaping, and since then, you know, in particular, Los Angeles Water and Power is planning a reclaimed water program that I believe is trying to reclaim up to about 1 million acre feet per year. And then in the agricultural areas, you know, of course, there's always room for improvement, but a lot of drip irrigation systems and things like that. But I think especially as we start shifting more, as the population grows over the next 50 years and we're shifting more from ag to municipal, I think the opportunities are going to be, you see greater benefits in the municipal areas.
Okay. Another question?
A delta conveyance system has been discussed for the past 40 years or so, and I was wondering if you could talk about what the possible energy uses would be with the various proposals, be it a peripheral canal or other systems.
That's a subject that I thought we were going to be able to avoid tonight. Just kidding. One of the first projects I worked on as a young engineer was renewing the design of the state of the peripheral canal back in 1980-81. And see, who was the governor then? But the delta conveyance system, as it's designed presently, and it's changing daily, so it's hard to pin down, requires the total pumping will require about 200 megawatts. And so, folks are going to try to make that, you know, as renewable a portfolio as possible. One of the advantages of having this Lodi Energy Center that we talked about is its proximity to the delta conveyance, if that happens, is very close. So there would be, you know, less transmission and greater opportunities there. So, but the plants that are presently discussed use about 200 megawatts of energy.
I thought we'd end on a positive note. Could you say a few words to us, please, about how comfortable you are with the role the DWR would play in disaster response should the big one come and the Delta levees sink slowly into the morass?
I will try to answer that. You know, sometimes there's a problem with knowing too much. I co-authored a 1991 report on the seismic evaluation of the Delta levees. And early in my career, I performed seismic evaluation of several of the dams in the state water project. So I'm kind of intimately familiar with exactly how they are. With respect to the water project, we are presently renewing our seismic evaluation of the water project minus the delta, because the delta is a different subject that I'll get to. With respect to our dams are, I think, in very safe condition. Most of them are under the jurisdiction of California Dam Safety, and many of them are also under the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which requires an independent review every 5 years of those facilities. And so that has been happening since day one of the project on a 5-year cycle. So I'm comfortable that, you know, we're doing everything we can to ensure safety there. The aqueduct and plants do not have that same kind of oversight. And so we are going through a program right now looking at the reliability of the aqueduct system, not only for seismic, but for other impacts that it might see. For example, in today's world, you know, what the likelihood of a terrorist attack on some of the facilities are being considered as well. And so that should be done in the next 4 to 5 years. It's a big project. With respect to Delta levees, I think they are very vulnerable. I think that a major earthquake that's close enough to cause the damage that, you know, that some of the analyses show are going to have a major impact on water supply in California. It's going to impact water quality primarily, which will impact the amount of water that you can export out of the Delta. And so it's, you know, having studied geotechnical engineering, in my mind, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And those folks like Norm Abrahamson, who was the seismologist for the new bridge here, the new Bay Bridge here, helped us with these studies. And it looks like, you know, I forget what the exact numbers are, but within the next 30 to 50 years, there's a very high likelihood that you're going to have that kind of event. And it's going to have a major impact on water supply.
Well,
and that's the positive note.
Well, please join me in thanking Ralph Torres from the State Water Project for this very informative discussion.
Thank you.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.